There is a real battle between the physical and the supraphysical. And the latest trends in materialism aim at avoiding the supraphysical to the farthest possible extent. And as Sri Aurobindo points out, this attempt of materialism to combat with the claims of the supraphysical has a great meaning for the advancement of mankind, because of the fact that the world of the supraphysical is a very complex world, and there are many layers of the supraphysical world. And unless we make a thorough study, we are likely to be caught into some kind of a realm of cloudiness, superstition, obscurantism. Therefore, it is right that materialism demands strict adherence to certain criteria of knowledge, of the truth, of validity. There have been in the past a number of instances which had sweeping effects upon the history of the earth, where the claims of the supraphysical came to be advocated so powerfully that superstitions began to rule, and this rule prevented the march of truth and true knowledge. The most disconcerting history of this conflict was in Europe, when in the name of revelation, a supraphysical claim, science was greatly obstructed. And there had to be a real battle between science and religion. Science in the march of time has triumphed. But in the meantime, science has come to be identified with materialism. And this is an exaggerated distortion. And that also needs to be clarified and corrected. We have to examine this question in a greater depth. And we have to ask ourselves whether the supraphysical can be examined scientifically. That is to say, by the methods of science, which consist basically of observation, experimentation, formation of hypothesis, and verification of hypothesis by reference to crucial data and arrival at a final conclusion, which again remains to be modifiable and needs to be verified once again in the expanding context of development of knowledge. The question is whether the supraphysical has been in the past examined from this point of view. In the West, there is a great difficulty in answering this question, because there is not that kind of tradition in the West, so powerfully developed as in India, namely the tradition of yoga. It is only in the field of yoga that a proper science of the supraphysical has been developed in India and has been kept alive. Even though there too there have been great aberrations. In the name of yoga, a good deal of pretension has been advocated. So-called yogis have claimed powers which they don't possess. So-called yogis have tried to influence people in the name of God's command when they do not have. And a lot of falsehood has spread in the name of yoga. Therefore, even in the field of yoga, there has to be a further scrutiny and a further conditioning of verification of the truth. And Sri Aurobindo, considering the fact that today's mankind has to pass through the crucibles of the supraphysical, there is no alternative. If it was possible for the man of today to surpass his difficulties without passing through the world of the supraphysical, one would have avoided this great difficult task. According to Sri Aurobindo, the present stage of evolution demands inevitably the crossing of the boundaries of the physical to the supraphysical. And not only the boundaries of supraphysical, but boundaries right up to the levels of the spiritual. Because all that is supraphysical is not spiritual. There are different gradations of the supraphysical. Only at a very high level of supraphysical we enter into the proper field of spirituality. Even this distinction is not sufficiently recognized. It is because of that reason that Sri Aurobindo prepares in the Life Divine a very big ground for training the students, candidates in mankind, who feel the call of the highest to pass through a very difficult testing ground. The debate between the physical and the supraphysical is not to be put under a carpet, which very often is an attempt made by many. We have got to confront the debate squarely. We have to understand the criticism of the physical against the supraphysical. This debate is fundamentally on one very important issue. First, that the supraphysical field is a field of subjectivity. The purely scientific field is a field of objectivity. And that the scientific knowledge can be tested on the ground of objectivity. Of course, there is a big question as to what is objectivity. And the answer is that objectivity consists of crossing the boundaries of subjective experience in a systematic manner. And this systematic measure is the following. The minimum is whether your subjective experience is also shared by another subjective experience. What I see here objectively present, or what I see here outside me, whether it is also seen by you, and the same object, this is the minimum standard of objectivity. The second is the standard of measurement, whether the distance between the subject and the object is properly measured. And similarly, the distance is measured from other subjective experiences, and whether these measures can be correlated, as a result of which you determine the location of the object precisely in the totality of the objective world. The third is calculation. Apart from measurement, whether whatever is calculated and measured can be verified in terms of larger laws of mathematics. Are there equations? And do the measurements come up to the standards of equations? And that is why mathematics and objectivity are very much regarded to be coterminous and very much supportive of each other. A further question is whether an error, if there is any, can be corrected, and the methods of correction are obtained or not. This also is a part of scientific methods and also has to be satisfied. And finally, whether whatever knowledge is obtained can be applied in some other similar circumstances, and whether consequences can be obtained, results can be obtained, and whether those consequences again satisfy all these methods which you have discussed. These are the fundamental methods of science developed today. And even then, philosophers of science conclude that even then, the knowledge obtained may not be necessarily certain. Knowledge may still remain probable. And this probability is also admitted by the scientists in the interest of the expansion of knowledge. This, in brief, is the compass of scientific knowledge, its effort at arrival at objectivity, and the criteria which have been developed in terms of the testing of the knowledge which is claimed to be true or false or erroneous or partly true or partly false or probable. Now, when we speak of supraphysical, and when we argue that supraphysical is also real, and not only that, but the supraphysical is a realm much larger than the physical world, and that the realities of the supraphysical world are distinguishable from one from the other, and there is a hierarchy of the supraphysical world, and that at the top of these hierarchies there are supreme worlds of knowledge, when such big claims are being made, we have to be even more scientific than any scientist can be. One of the most important statements of Sri Aurobindo in regard to the development of the synthesis of yoga has been that both Sri Aurobindo and the mother, while developing this synthesis of yoga, have applied their knowledge not merely on the basis of faith, but by development of tests of that knowledge more scrupulously than any scientist can have with regard to his field of knowledge. This is what Sri Aurobindo himself has written. So one can imagine the kind of scruple that has gone into the making of this synthesis of yoga. It is only because of this great scruple that has been utilized by Sri Aurobindo the mother that today we can speak more confidently. And it is only then that we can speak of avoiding the great dangers that lie in the path of the supraphysical. Because Sri Aurobindo admits that the supraphysical world and supraphysical worlds, when you cross through them, are extremely perilous. And although there are greater aids also available, the perils cannot be avoided altogether. And we have to lay down strict conditions under which these perils can be safeguarded against. Now there is a very important paragraph in the Life Divine where Sri Aurobindo discusses this question of the standards of truth which are to be applied in regard to the supraphysical. I think there is a very important paragraph. There is a chapter called Order of the Worlds. Pardon? I don't know what will be your page number in your... No, that is the beginning. It is called the Order of the Worlds. And if you open that chapter, the paragraph which I want to read with you is paragraph number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 and 10. In paragraph number 9, in the middle of the paragraph, there is a sentence. It is a fact that mankind almost from the beginning, have you got that line? Just before that. It is a fact. From there, I would like to read with you these 2-3 paragraphs because they are extremely important from this point of view. Sri Aurobindo first of all says that in history of the world, supraphysical has been admitted right from early times of man's development. And there have been intimations from the supraphysical worlds which have played a great role in shaping human civilization. Even, for example, the Ten Commandments, which has been very powerful in Christianity and in Judaism, is supposed to have been received by Moses on the Sinai mountain. That revelation, it is not something fabricated by Moses. It's claimed that he received the commandments from God for mankind. Now, phenomena of this kind have played a great role in the development of humanity. Even before that, there have been many other claims of experiences. Even in the story of Genesis, there are so many supraphysical facts which even today are influencing mankind in their beliefs. This whole field of the supraphysical is a tremendous field. And if we really want to know the whole world, the present condition of mankind, the future of mankind, if you want to consider where we stand, and what is the highest that we can do? Even if you want to escape this great inquiry, we cannot escape it. This inquiry is necessary. And that is why a great effort is required. If it was avoidable, one did not read the Life Divine. Such a big effort it is. But it is unavoidable. Anyone who wants to know what is to be done at the highest possible level for the world, this knowledge is absolutely indispensable. And that is why in this book, the fundamentals are described, and the synthesis of yoga, detailed descriptions of the supraphysical world are described. And in Savitri, for example, as I said yesterday, these descriptions have been most accurately been depicted. And this knowledge is necessary. And it is in that context that the battle between the physical and the supraphysical has to be rightly debated. It is not to gain victory of one over the other. It is in the very interest of knowledge and development of mankind. The destiny of mankind is at stake. It is not to win a battle of the physical against the supraphysical or of the supraphysical against the physical. It's a very important debate. Therefore, Sri Aurobindo says, it is a fact that mankind, almost from the beginning of its existence, or so far back as history or tradition can go, has believed in the existence of other worlds and in the possibility of communication between their powers and beings and the human race. In the last rationalistic period of human thought from which we are emerging, this belief has been swept aside as an age-long superstition. All evidence or intimations of its truth have been rejected a priori as fundamentally false and undeserving of inquiry because incompatible with the axiomatic truth that only matter and the material world and its experiences are real. All other experience purporting to be real must be either a hallucination or an imposture or a subjective result of superstitious credulity and imagination, or else if a fact, then other than what it purported to be and explicable by a physical cause. No evidence could be accepted of such a fact unless it is objective and physical in character. Even if the fact be very apparently supraphysical, it cannot be accepted as such unless it is totally unexplainable by any other imaginable hypothesis or conceivable conjecture. This is the condition of the modern scientific mind. Now Sri Aurobindo gives arguments in order to show, first of all, the inadequacies of the materialistic demands of science. Then points out how much is the truth behind the demands of the materialistic science. How much of these truths have also to be satisfied in regard to the supraphysical world and the claims regarding supraphysical world, and how a new science of the supraphysical can be developed and can be applied. This paragraph, this and next paragraph, are extremely important from that point of view. In fact, I had the privilege of reading out these two paragraphs to the mother one time, and she was very keen that these paragraphs should be presented to young people in the world, because these two paragraphs give a very brief. This is what modern young people want, an answer which is brief and yet very precise and very pointed and something on which you can hold with precision. And these two paragraphs, therefore, are extremely important. So I shall read out to you. It should be evident that this demand for physical valid proof of a supraphysical fact is irrational and illogical. It is an irrelevant attitude of the physical mind which assumes that only the objective and physical is fundamentally real and puts aside all else as merely subjective. Now Sri Aurobindo goes further about the claims of the supraphysical and to what extent a supraphysical fact can also be tested physically. But the basic point is that if someone says there is a supraphysical world and you are asked, show me physically. If I say that there is a supraphysical world and I demand from him, show me physically, you can see the irrelevance of it. If in the very nature, if what I am speaking about is supraphysical, how can I show you physically? So to demand, so to make a demand for physical verification of a supraphysical is itself irrational, illogical. So that is the first point. It doesn't mean therefore that the claim of the supraphysical is immediately conceded. A supraphysical fact, you can say, has to be proved supraphysically. So that demand still remains. I may not make a demand that I show me physically, but I cannot say therefore the supraphysical fact requires no proof at all. The only answer is supraphysical fact needs to be proved, if not by physical proof, by supraphysical proof. And are there supraphysical proofs at all? This is a very important question. But before that, Sri Aurobindo says, it is true that even a supraphysical fact can be proved physically. It's not entirely impossible. First, a supraphysical fact may impinge on the physical world and produce physical results. It may even produce an effect on our physical senses and become manifest to them. But that cannot be its invariable action and most normal character or process. Ordinarily, it must produce a direct effect or a tangible impression on our mind and our life being, which are the parts of us that are of the same order as itself, and can only indirectly and through them, if at all, influence the physical world and physical life. If it objectivizes itself, it must be to a subtler sense in us, and only derivatively to the outward physical sense. This derivative objectivization is certainly possible if there is an association of the action of the subtle physical body and its sense organization with the action of the material body and its physical organs, then the supraphysical can become outwardly sensible to us. This is what happens when some people can see the auras of certain individuals. Auras are in themselves supraphysical, and they can be only seen not by physical senses, but by supraphysical senses. Such senses also operate. People don't believe in them, but they do operate. And it is true that by supraphysical senses, you can take cognizance of the supraphysical facts. But it is also possible, if these supraphysical senses are greatly associated in some cases, even with the physical consciousness, then what is supraphysical can also be seen physically. And therefore, some people can even see supraphysical things which are not ordinarily seen by many other people. Like in the famous story of Nivedita, the young boy could see Sri Krishna every day in the forest, can even see supraphysical things which are not ordinarily seen by many other people. Like in the famous story of Nivedita, the young boy could see Sri Krishna every day in the forest. His mother had told him that for going to the school, you have to pass through a forest, and you are a very young boy, and if you are afraid, your elder brother lives in the forest. You just call him and he will come and take you. So whenever he had a difficulty, he did so, and the elder brother did appear and took him out of the forest, and therefore he had no difficulty in going from his home to the school. And one day he had a problem of milk, because there was a birthday of his teacher, and all the students of the school were supposed to bring some gift, and particularly some kind of milk or something of the kind, as a gift to the teacher. And the boy had a big problem. He told the mother that we are very poor, and I know, how can you give me milk, but what shall I do? Should I ask my elder brother? So the elder brother, mother said, yes, you call him. So he called him, and the elder brother gave him a small little vessel in which there was a little milk. And he took him and gave it to the teacher. And the teacher had many good presents from so many people. And the teacher went on putting all the milk together in a big vessel. And the small child, he was very afraid now, my portion is only a little bit. And he took it. And the teacher, of course, out of indulgence, he took it, because hardly it was going to make any addition to the totality of the milk. And he began to pour it, and pour it, and pour it, and pour it. It did not end. It went on and on and on. And vessels after vessels were filled with that milk. And the teacher was so astonished and said, what is it? From where have you got it? He said, my elder brother gave it to me. It's a beautiful story written by Sister Nivedita in the Cradle Tales of Hinduism. Very interesting story. And then the teacher said, who is your elder brother? He said, well, he is all the time with me. Whenever I go, whenever I call him, he comes. So the teacher said, then let me come and let me see with you who is your elder brother. He went with the forest and said, boy called out, and Sri Krishna came. And then the boy said, here is he, here he is. The teacher said, I don't see him. So he told his elder brother, said, he can't see you, what is the matter? So he said, he can't see, don't worry, I can only see, you can only see me. Now, the point is, a supraphysical can be seen even physically in a certain state of consciousness. This story may be regarded only as a fiction to be told to children, who may feel amused, but it is a fact. In all spiritual experiences, you can. I mean, Mirabai used to say that she saw Sri Krishna. And there are many, many, even they saw actual physical forms. They could even touch the physical forms. And these are the claims of spiritual masters, in fact. So Sri Aurobindo says, it is perfectly possible to have objectivization of these experiences, but it is not that only this objectivization could be the method of proving it. In itself it is supraphysical. It can be objectivized. You can see it even physically, but that need not be the inevitable and the indispensable method of proving. The proof does not lie in that. That also could be. But If you really want the proof of the supraphysical, you must have supraphysical means of verification. Actually speaking, we do not ask the question, what is this physical perception of an objective physical fact? Why is there a physical experience of physical reality? And this question is not sufficiently debated even by scientists. It is assumed. We have physical senses and you can see the physical world. But if you ask epistemologically, why the physical world can be seen only by physical senses? What is the reason? What is the connection between physical senses and the physical world? Why do I perceive the physical world? What is the physical sense? And actually speaking, we know that physical sense is only an instrument. It's not the sense by itself. The eyes and ears and so on are only instruments. It's like a microscope. And microscope, when you see yourself, is seen through another microscope, as if another organ. But seeing takes place in the retina, and even there one doesn't know. There is a sense which is not, it is the instrument is not the sense. If the sense is absent, and even if the physical organ is present, this is what we experience very often in what is called absent-minded perception. I may stand on the street in a state of great anxiety and I see people passing. I don't notice people passing around me. My mind is absent. That is, the organs are open, the instruments are open. But the sense is not concentrated upon it. Somebody touches me in my sleep. The touch is there, the instrument is there. There is the same impact as ordinarily there is an impact on my body. I don't feel it. Because something that is other than the skin, other than the instrument, is absent. In other words, there is a difference between the instrument and the sense itself. And what is this sense? It's not physical. That sense is not physical organ. What is that sense? It is in itself supraphysical. And this is not sufficiently recognized or understood. That basically sense itself is supraphysical. And even the object that we see, what is that object which I call physical? Is it really physical as in itself? If you really believe the modern science that this table consists of protons and electrons and so on, and that is the real reality of it. And these are like hollows, actually speaking. If you take a picture of this table as it is full of hollows, which I don't perceive at all. So in what sense is my perception of this table an objectively real experience? Now these questions are not at all debated by scientists. They are, as it were, a priori. You don't question, this is what happens. I must have this thing happening with my physical senses. Whatever that sense may be, I must have this measurement, I must have this experience, and that is all. But it is certainly refusal to inquire further. We must inquire, what is really the sense? That is why in India it is said that manas is a sense, sixth sense. It is recognized in India. Manas is a sense. And manas is not an organ, physical organ at all. It is recognized to be the sixth sense. And the powers of this sense can be cultivated, as a result of which many phenomena which are not dependent of physical senses can be had. And in fact, as Sri Aurobindo says, all the world is actually more than 9/10 supraphysical. Only physical is a little fret, a little margin of the supraphysical. Whole world, we are all the time living in a great supraphysical world. Everything is supraphysical, basically. Our emotions are supraphysical, feelings are supraphysical, our senses are supraphysical, our aspirations are supraphysical, our relationships are supraphysical. We live constantly in a supraphysical existence. And we take pell-mell our world as it is. And there is a kind of a feeling that this world is tangible only when we can touch it. But this is a demand which itself requires to be questioned. In fact, you should demand a deeper demand. Are there supraphysical senses by means of which the supraphysical world can be touched? The proof of a supraphysical world should be based upon supraphysical perception. Can you supraphysically, by supraphysical sense, can you see supraphysical world? And if you have measurements of that, then you can have another science, a much better science, much more important science, and that is what is absolutely necessary for us to develop. We move forward. This derivative objectivization is certainly possible. If there is an association of the action of the subtle body and its sense organization with the action of the material body and its physical organs, then the supraphysical can become outwardly sensible to us. This is what happens, for example, with a faculty called second sight. It is the process of all those psychic phenomena which seem to be seen and heard by the outer senses and are not sensed inwardly through representative or interpretative or symbolic images which bear the stamp of an inner experience or have an evident character of formations in a subtle substance. There can then be various kinds of evidence of the existence of other planes of being and communication with them. Objectivization to the outer sense, subtle sense context, mind context, life context, context to the subliminal in special states of consciousness exceeding our ordinary range. Our physical mind is not the whole of us, nor, even though it dominates almost the whole of our surface consciousness, the best or greatest part of us. Reality cannot be restricted to a sole field of this narrowness or to the dimensions known within its rigid circle. There is a very interesting lecture that Swami Vivekananda gave in America. It is reproduced, the whole lecture is reproduced under the title Powers of the Mind. I don't know if that book is easily available here with you. If you bring it, I'll be able to, because it's a very interesting evidence, which he has provided from his own personal experience and example. And these facts which he has described, even today when you Swami Vivekananda has narrated them and narrated in a lecture that he has given, they need to be taken quite seriously. It is his personal experience and account of his own personal encounter. And it's amazing. And I cannot even today can explain this particular phenomenon that he had seen with somebody whom he had gone to see along with his friends. And it was said about him that he can foretell the things and he can, has many powers and so on. And let me read out to you because it's a very interesting account that he himself has given. And there is a need today in our present world to collect all these authentic facts and present to the field of knowledge. It is a knowledge which sometimes is, in India for example, it is left to be believed for those who want to believe and to go ahead with the physical world as it is and not to bother too much about it. But I think the time has grown very ripe when one has to make a very serious study of this and make a real science of it and develop it further. And fortunately, with a lot of literature now available from Sri Aurobindo and the mother, this would be not so difficult to, and also therefore to lay down the conditions and even to test so that charlatans can be exposed. And you can say that people who claim falsely, even these false claims can be examined and can be exposed. And that also is necessary, because in the name of the supraphysical, anything goes. And people begin to have great experiences and great faith, and afterwards they are found to be fake. And then you feel you were deceived in your life. Oh, you got it? Oh, thank you. Jyoti, can you read out this chapter? Because it will give me some relief. Read from the beginning.
The powers of the mind, is that too loud? The powers of the mind. Delivered at Los Angeles, California, January 8, 1900. All over the world, there has been the belief in the supernatural throughout the ages. All of us have heard of extraordinary happenings, and many of us have had some personal experience of them. I would rather introduce the subject by telling you certain facts which have come within my own experience. I once heard of a man who, if anyone went to him with questions in his mind, would answer them immediately. And I was also informed that he foretold events. I was curious and went to see him with a few friends. We each had something in our minds to ask, and to avoid mistakes, we wrote down our questions and put them in our pockets. As soon as the man saw one of us, he repeated our questions and gave the answers to them. Then he wrote something on paper, which he folded up, asked me to sign on the back, and said, "Don't look at it. Put it in your pocket and keep it there till I ask for it again." And so on to each one of us. He next told us about some events that would happen to us in the future. Then he said, "Now think of a word or a sentence from any language you like." I thought of a long sentence from Sanskrit, a language of which he was entirely ignorant. "Now take out the paper from your pocket," he said. The Sanskrit sentence was written there. He had written it in an hour before with the remark, quote, "In confirmation of what I have written, this man will think of this sentence," unquote. It was correct. Another of us who had been given a similar paper, which he had signed and placed in his pocket, was also asked to think of a sentence. He thought of a sentence in Arabic, which it was still less possible for the man to know. It was some passage from the Quran. And my friend found this written down on the paper. Another of us was a physician. He thought of a sentence from a German medical book. It was written on his paper. Several days later, I went to this man again, thinking possibly I had been deluded somehow before. I took other friends, and on this occasion also, he came out wonderfully triumphant. Another time, I was in the city of Hyderabad in India, and I was told of a Brahmin there who could produce numbers of things from where nobody knew. This man was in business there. He was a respectable gentleman, and I asked him to show me his tricks. It so happened that this man had a fever. And in India, there is a general belief that if a holy man puts his hand on a sick man, he would be well. This Brahmin came to me and said, "Sir, put your hand on my head so that my fever may be cured." I said, "Very good, but you show me your tricks." He promised. I put my hand on his head as desired, and later he came to fulfill his promise. He had only a strip of cloth about his loins. We took off everything else from him. I had a blanket which I gave him to wrap round himself because it was cold, and made him sit in a corner. 25 pairs of eyes were looking at him, and he said, "Now look, write down anything you want." We all wrote down names of fruits that never grew in that country, bunches of grapes, oranges, and so on. And we gave him those bits of paper. And there came from under his blanket bushels of grapes, oranges, and so forth. So much that if all that fruit was weighed, it would have been twice as heavy as the man. He asked us to eat the fruit. Some of us objected, thinking it was hypnotism. But the man began eating himself, so we all ate. It was all right.
Exactly.
As you will see, Sri Aurobindo speaks of objectivization to the outer sense, subtle sense context, mind context, life context, context to the subliminal in special states of consciousness exceeding our ordinary range. Now these are different levels of experiences of the supraphysical. And therefore, the science of the supraphysical existence is a very wide-ranging science. And a good study would require not merely a kind of a book opened and studying, because many of these things cannot be even understood unless we have some elements of experience. Therefore, the study of the supraphysical science also requires a good deal of experience, and the two things should go side by side. And it is important to observe that the study of the supraphysical, which has been best done, is in the yogic science. And yoga is conceived as a science. And this yoga demands fulfillment of a number of conditions, both for the entry into the science and then continuation in that scientific field and arrival at some mastery of this great science. In the course of development, a great stress is laid upon three preliminary conditions: the development of the powers of concentration, secondly, purification, and thirdly, renunciation. These three are the preconditions for the study of the supraphysical. And it should be made very clear that unless one is prepared to undergo these three things, one should not be admitted even to the field of the supraphysical, because the field of supraphysical is a perilous field. And for protecting oneself and the others from the perils of this entry, one has to take a great precaution. It is a kind of precaution that you take even with regard to physical sciences. If you enter into a laboratory of physics or chemistry or biology, you are required to undergo certain previous training. Anybody and everybody cannot be admitted to the laboratories, and certain conditions have to be fulfilled. Even certain attitude of the mind has to be developed. A scientist has to be impartial. Now, this is a psychological condition of study of any science, to develop impartiality. And then the capacity to evaluate observations, not only by pure impartiality, but also certain skills of evaluation. Thirdly, patience. A scientist has to be extremely patient. And this is not a very easy demand. But a good scientist has to be very patient. A good scientist also has to be told that you might work on your field for years and years without arriving at any result, and therefore not to be frustrated if you don't get the result. that even the spirit of competition in the field of science may be perilous, may be injurious, both to oneself as to the others. There are occasions when your competitor arrives at a discovery much earlier than you, and it might frustrate you from an egoistic point of view. Therefore, one is advised not to be egoistic. Even for a good science, these mental qualities are required. They may not be fulfilled by everybody, but they are required. Also, one requires a theoretical training before you can enter into practical applications. And anybody and everybody cannot be allowed to do experiments unless the theoretical training has reached a certain advanced stage. Now, that is true even of the physical sciences. In the supraphysical sciences, the conditions have to be even more strict. And that is why in India we had a great system of Guru-Shishya Parampara. It was not a kind of a tradition for respecting and all that sort of thing. But considering the perils of the development of powers and perceptions, one has to be very careful. And these three powers particularly, which I spoke of, have to be underlined. The powers of concentration, the necessity of purification, and the readiness for renunciation. If these three qualities are not satisfied, one should be told that you are not qualified. Certain conditions have to be fulfilled, particularly when you enter an experimental laboratory of this kind. These conditions are extremely important, and they have to be guarded. Even when these conditions are accepted, people go haywire, even after developing at a certain level, and there are all kinds of revolts, all kinds of exaggerations of egoism, the manifestations of greed and egoism and power. All these aberrations do take place. And that is why we had a rule in Patanjali, for example. It is said that for several years, don't do any practice excepting Yama and Niyama. In Jainism, for example, these Yamas and Niyamas are all important. And that is very, very important. It is not easy unless you are truthful, unless you are self-controlled, unless you have certain compassion for everybody, unless you are able to renounce a parigraha. Is a very difficult training in which you do not store anything for tomorrow, for the next day. You depend only upon what you get today, and you don't bother about tomorrow. You have to say that next day you will get what is necessary. It may come, it may not come, but you cannot store it for tomorrow, thinking that tomorrow nobody will come and give you anything. Of course, now Jainism is so well spread that nobody has to bother very much about it. And there are lines of invitations for you. See, it doesn't matter. But fundamentally, the idea of aparigraha is extremely important. And then the niyamas of santosha, shaucha, swadhyaya, and so on. These are also very, very important niyamas. So it is said that unless you follow these yamas and niyamas for a long time, you are not fit to enter into the field of yoga. And it's a part of the science actually. It's a kind of a laboratory conditions for your entry into yoga. It's very often it is so much connected with religiosity and superstition, but it is not that. It is just to have a recognition of the perils of the problem and to satisfy that you are giving sufficient protection to the individual who enters into it that these yamas and niyamas have been framed. For the development of these supraphysical sciences, you have to first of all study subtle physical, and that is a vast field. And then there is what Sherbindo calls the subliminal. A subliminal consists of the subtle physical, inner vital, and inner mental. And then there is the question of the psychic consciousness. So that is a still deeper a science of psychic experiences. And then there are other domains of the superconscience, the domain of the higher mind and illumined mind and intuitive mind and over mind and super mind. So, and these are all scientific processes, that is to say, you can distinguish between over mind and super mind, you can distinguish between intuitive mind and over mind and so on. In fact, a cursory study of some of the letters of Sri Aurobindo on poetry, it is very interesting where Sri Aurobindo has commented upon poetical creations of some of his disciples, where he has even said, this particular line is from intuitive mind, this line comes from higher mind, this is psychic, this is over-mental, and so on. Even with regard to some of the poets, great poets and their poetry, Sri Aurobindo has made a remark as to what are the levels on which these poetical creations have been created. Now, unless you have a great scientific spirit and scientific scruple, you cannot arrive at this kind of clarity and precision. In other words, in Sri Aurobindo's records of yoga and mother's agenda, you have so much scientific literature available for the whole science that if one can make a study, one can create, even write a manual of this science, which is very, very important and very useful for in due course of time. Now we continue the argument, however. If it be said that subjective experience or subtle sense images can easily be deceptive, this is the argument, that subjective experiences can be deceptive. There can be a lot of errors about it. Since we have no recognized method or standard of verification and a too great tendency to admit the extraordinary and miraculous or supernatural at its face value, this may be admitted. It's a very important statement. If somebody says that subjective experiences can be very deceptive, and there's a tendency to allow truth for falsehood and falsehood for the truth, Sri Aurobindo says that this tendency is there, it should be admitted. But then there is a cure, and a cure has to be found. And this is what Sri Aurobindo answers. But error is not the prerogative of the inner subjective or subliminal parts of us. It is also an appendage of the physical mind and its objective methods and standards. And such liability to error cannot be a reason for shutting out a large and important domain of experience. It is a reason rather for scrutinizing it and finding out in its own true standards and its characteristic, appropriate and valid means of verification. This is the important condition, that in order to build up a true science, one should not be afraid of the mistakes that will be committed. Errors are also in the physical sciences. Merely error should not be the reason for shutting out the inquiry. Any inquiry creates a possibility of an error. The point is whether you developed standards and methods of verification by means of which errors can be detected, deceptions can be minimized and eliminated. Now Sri Aurobindo's 10-point is that such standards of verification are available in the field of supraphysical sciences. And this is not very widely known, and that is why the great difficulty. That there are supraphysical methods of verification. If somebody says, oh, whenever I close my eyes, I see the green color. That means that the individual has a contact. There is no green color around, and yet when I close my eyes, I see green color all the time. Now, is it that he's imagining? Is it as after image? There is nothing green here, and yet when I close my eyes, I get green color before my eyes. Usually, when you close your eyes, it is darkness. But somebody says, I see green color all the time. What does it mean? And then he says, you know, it is a very high divine light I am seeing, green light all the time. If he makes a claim, you can say, my dear friend, please wait. The green color is not the normal color of a divine light. It's a scientific statement. The green light is a light of the vital world. When you enter the vital world, you normally have the vision of green light. Now, this is a great science developed by tantrics. Tantra is a great science of yoga. It has developed a very strict and very scrupulous science. And when you read Sri Aurobindo's letters on visions and voices, it's a wonderful chapter in the letters on yoga, visions and voices, where Sri Aurobindo has given a detailed meaning of different lights and different colors and the meanings of it, and that the figures which are seen, like if you see a deer in your vision, it means speed of yogic development and so on. If you see an aeroplane in the vision, what does it mean? If you see a train, if you see a cart in your vision. So there are all kinds of standards of verification have been determined. Yogic science is a very well-developed science in India. It's only because this science is not being developed and transmitted properly that today, generally, mankind remains in India. Even in India, people are all bewildered. All kinds of claims are being made, and everybody is passing off as if a great spiritual saint, a great experience has come, and so on. Somebody producing a ring suddenly and says, "This is now divine power." It may be only power of materialization. And even a saint like Ramakrishna could not give you a ring. But some other person can give a ring, like this man about whom Swami Vivekananda spoke. That man was not like Sri Ramakrishna, but he was able to produce grapes and fruits and so on. Now, if you are a real yogic scientist, you will not put that man into the hierarchy of a saint. Many saints may not be able to do all that. Others may be able to do it. But there are differences and different kinds of powers and different availabilities of powers. It is because in India this knowledge has been covered up and misutilized that there is a lot of misunderstanding. But a time has come when this knowledge has to be manifested scientifically. So Sri Aurobindo says, it is a reason rather for scrutinizing it and finding out in it its own true standards and its characteristic appropriate and valid means of verification. Our subjective being is the basis of our objective experience. And it is not probable that only its physical objectivizations are true and the rest unreliable. This sentence is one of the most important sentences. I read again. In fact, twice I would like you to read it. It's a very important sentence. Our subjective being is the basis of our objective experience. This is because physical scientists demand always objective standards of truth. Now, this objective standard of truth is a very good demand, and we must insist upon it. And even for subjective experiences of the supraphysical, we must demand objective standards of truth. But we must understand the rationale behind it properly. What is the rationale? What is objective? And who understands the objective? This is an important question. What is objective? And who understands the objective? Who determines that the objective is objective? The answer is, it's all subjective. It is the subjective which understands what is objective. It is subjective that understands that objective is objective. In other words, our subjectivity has a very special capacity. Our subjectivity is capable inwardly to determine what is objective and what is not objective. Our subjective consciousness has within it a power to discriminate what is purely objective and what is purely subjective. All sincere people are able to do it. The condition is of sincerity. And that's a very important condition. And in yoga, for example, it is said, the most important element and condition that you should fulfill in yoga is sincerity. If you are not sincere, you are likely to exaggerate your egoism. You are likely to exaggerate the truth of your experience. You are likely to believe that what you feel, experience, subjectively you say it is right. It is your sincerity which gives you the real value and which tells you, be sure you are really objectively seeing. When I come out of my dream, sometimes the dreams are so vivid as if things are seen objectively. The kind of experience that was described by our great dramatist in Swapna Vasavadattam. Vasavadatta was seen as in a dream. That is what he felt. It was a dream. Actually, it was not a dream. It was an objective Vasudatta who was there, and when he opened his eyes, she had just slipped away. Therefore, she was not to be found. But it's a very interesting psychological example. Unless you are extremely sincere and truly in search of objectivity, You can claim subjective experience to be objective and objective to be subjective. Sometimes even if you see objectively something, so this is only subjective. Why? Because you are not so scrutinizing consciousness. And Sri Aurobindo says that even what scientists believe to be objective, even the objective standard is created by subjective experience of the scientists. It is up to the subjective consciousness of the scientists which have determined that unless you have these proofs, don't regard it to be objective. Merely because you have seen, even if you have seen in your waking consciousness, even when you have cleaned your eyes properly and seen, even then don't think that what is objectively seen is objective. You ask your friend, do you see also the same thing? Now this criterion, who builds up? It is the scientist himself, that you can be wrong. Even when you see very clearly, you may be not right. Ask somebody else, can you see the same thing? Sometimes even when your friend says, I see it, he may not be right. So even that, you have to find out whether you are also seeing it or not. Merely because somebody says, I see it, he should not say, I see it. Even then, don't believe it. You should measure the distance between you and the object. Now all these standards have been built by the subjective consciousness of the scientists. In other words, subjective consciousness is capable of so much of sincerity that it builds up its own standards of truth. And if it can build up such standards of truth even with regard to the physical reality, why should it not be possible for the subjective consciousness to develop subjective standards of objectivity? It should be possible. If you read the mother's agenda, for example, the kind of scrutiny that she has of her own experiences is amazing. What tremendous scruple. One has to collect so many of data to show how scrupulous one has to be so that subjective wish need not be or cannot be regarded as fulfillment even if you have some probing effects. You should be very, very careful. You should repeat your experience once, twice, three times, five times, 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times. Some of the things that Sri Aurobindo has written have been verified 1,000s of times, not a few times. That's why Sri Aurobindo says that even no scientist would have been so scrupulous in his testing as he and the mother have been in regard to the development of this great science. So, this sentence is a very important sentence. Our subjective being is the basis of our objective experience. And it is not probable that only its physical objectivizations are true and the rest unreliable. The subliminal consciousness, when rightly interrogated, is a witness to truth, and its testimony is confirmed again and again, even in the physical and the objective field. That testimony cannot then be disregarded when it calls our attention to things within us or to things that belong to planes or worlds of our supraphysical experience. At the same time, belief by itself is not evidence of reality. Again, a very important sentence. At the same time, belief by itself is not evidence of reality. It must base itself on something more valid before one can accept it. It is evident that beliefs of the past are not a sufficient basis for knowledge. even though they cannot be entirely neglected. For a belief is a mental construction and may be a wrong building. It may often answer to some inner intimation, and then it has a value. But as often as not, it disfigures the intimation, usually by a translation into terms familiar to our physical and objective experience, such as that which converted the hierarchy of the planes into a physical hierarchy or geographical space extension, turned the rarer heights of subtle substance into the material heights and placed the abodes of the gods on the summits of physical mountains, like Shiva living on the top of the Himalayas, saying that it is this physical Himalayas, not really seeing that what is described in the Puranas as the abodes of the gods are supraphysical worlds, and they are not to be converted into physical terms and say he has an abode here or there. There are abodes, that is true, but those abodes are not physical, not in the physical mountains, but in the supraphysical mountains. All truths, supraphysical or physical, must be founded not on mental belief alone, but on experience. But in each case, experience must be of the kind, physical, subliminal or spiritual, which is appropriate to the order of the truths into which we are empowered to enter. Their validity and significance must be scrutinized, but according to their own law and by consciousness which can enter into them, and according to the law of another domain, or by consciousness which is capable only of truths of another order. So alone can we be sure of our steps and enlarge firmly our sphere of knowledge. These are the conditions which are to be remembered, and if materialism of today has opposed the supraphysical, we have to be grateful to it. Because unless the mankind has become sufficiently ripe, sufficiently purified, sufficiently scrupulous, not to jump into conclusions immediately on some flimsy experiences, unless mankind is sufficiently baked, it is not safe to enter into this field. So we go back again to the chapter that we are reading. This was only a kind of a supplement which I thought necessary, because it explains much more clearly what Sri Aurobindo means by saying that materialism has given a great help to us by not allowing into the supraphysical, even obstructing, even denying the supraphysical, until we are quite ready for it. And this service materialism has given, but now is the time to go further. This is the time where we have reached now. I think if you take this paragraph, the unknown is not the unknowable. It's page number 13. This is the starting point of the new inquiry. When you are sufficiently trained in the physical inquiry, which over the last 400 years mankind has been trained sufficiently well, then we have to say now, there is still much that remains unknown. And Sri Aurobindo says, the unknown is not the unknowable. It need not remain the unknown for us, unless we choose ignorance or persist in our first limitations. For to all things that are not unknowable, all things in the universe, there correspond in that universe faculties which can take cognizance of them. This is a great statement of Sri Aurobindo, that you can be sure that any object of knowledge, if it exists, there is also a faculty in human consciousness which can take cognizance of it. The world is nothing but the world that is at once subjective and objective. We may not recognize it, we may not believe in it, but it's a fact. That is why in Sankhya philosophy, there is a state of evolution that has been described in which the physical objects, the Pancha Mahabhutas and Tanmatras have correspondence. If there is the earth, earth can be basically touched. If there is something that can be seen, there is a sight, the visible object corresponds to the capacity of sensing. So there is a correspondence between the sense of sight and the objective vision which is available in the physical world. All the Panch Mahabhutas are connected with the Tanmatras, and because of the Tanmatras we are able to perceive the corresponding objects in the world. Now what is true in the physical world is also true at higher in the supraphysical worlds. For every particular level of existence, the vital world can be seen by the vital consciousness. The mental world can be seen by the mental world, by the mental consciousness. Psychic consciousness can see the psychic world, and so on. Corresponding to every world, which is supraphysical, there is in us a corresponding faculty. So, Sri Aurobindo says that, for to all things that are not unknowable, all things in the universe, there correspond in that universe faculties which can take cognizance of them. And in man, the microcosm, these faculties are always existent and at a certain stage capable of development. We may choose not to develop them. Where they are partially developed, we may discourage and impose on them a kind of atrophy. But fundamentally, all possible knowledge is knowledge within the power of humanity. And since in man there is the inalienable impulse of nature towards self-realization, no struggle of the intellect to limit the action of our capacities within a determined area can forever prevail. This is the effort of the modern times. We say, don't enter into supraphysical. It's a false world. It doesn't exist. But man, his basic urge is to know himself, self-realization. Even if you stop him, you can stop him for some time. A time must come when he has to break open his being and really see within himself what he is. And fortunately, for seeing himself, the real faculties are also present in him. Therefore, all the levels of man's real self-realization are available. When we have proved matter and realized its secret capacities, the very knowledge which has found its convenience in that temporary limitation must cry out to us, like the Vedic restrainers, forth now and push forward also in other fields. There is the Vedic experience that there are Vritras who are restrainers. They are the ones who build dams for the water so that waters are restrained. And when you are in search of knowledge and the waters of knowledge, then Ritras come and stop your movement. But it is your persistent purification, your renunciation, your concentration, these three elements, to develop them. And when your tests are successful, then these very restrainers will tell you, now we open the gates for you, you push forth. Sri Aurobindo says that modern materialists were only vritras of this kind. Mankind has now persisted, and if your persistence is proved to be valid, then even the physical scientists will come and tell you, push forth and attain to higher knowledge of the supraphysical. And Sri Aurobindo says, today mankind has reached that point of development. Therefore, in the next paragraph, Sri Aurobindo says, if modern materialism were simply an unintelligent acquiescence in the material life, the advance might be indefinitely delayed. But since its very soul is a search for knowledge, it will be unable to cry a halt. Materialism itself, because its search is for knowledge, so it will never cry a permanent halt. As it reaches the barriers of sense knowledge and of the reasoning from sense knowledge, its very rush will carry it beyond. And the rapidity and sureness with which it has embraced the visible universe is only an earnest of the energy and success which we may hope to see repeated in the conquest of what lies beyond. Once a stride is taken that crosses the barrier, we are already that advance in its obscure beginnings. This is the reading of our time, and that is why we stand at a very important moment where we need not fear to advance into the supraphysical realms and into the realms of yoga. As our time is limited, I'll be pardoned if I omit a few paragraphs while reading, so that at least the first four chapters are completed by tomorrow. And I would like you to come to the paragraph which says, what is that work and result? In that paragraph, we have third or fourth line, science itself begins, if you got that line. Have you got it? So I connect what I have read so far with this sentence. It's a direct link actually. All the remaining is a kind of elucidation. Now you come to this next point. Science itself begins to dream of the physical conquest of death, expresses an insatiable thirst for knowledge, is working out something like a terrestrial omnipotence for humanity. Space and time are contracting to the vanishing point in its work. And it strives in 100 ways to make man the master of circumstance and so lighten the fetters of causality. The idea of limit of the impossible begins to grow a little shadowy, and it appears instead that whatever man constantly wills, he must in the end be able to do. For the consciousness in the race eventually finds the means. It is not in the individual that this omnipotence expresses itself, but the collective will of mankind, that works out with the individual as a means. And yet, when we look more deeply, it is not any conscious will of the collectivity, but a superconscious might that uses the individual as a center and means. The collectivity is a condition and field. What is this but the God in man? The infinite identity, the multitudinous unity, the omniscient, the omnipotent, who having made man in his own image, with the ego as a center of working, with the race, collective Narayana, the Vishwamanava, as the mold and circumscription, seeks to express in them some image of the unity, omniscience, omnipotence, which are the self-conception of the divine. That which is immortal in mortals is a God, and established inwardly as an energy, working out in our divine powers. It is this vast cosmic impulse which the modern world, without quite knowing its own aim, yet serves in all its activities and labors subconsciously to fulfill. So this is the real reading of the March of Knowledge of today. But there is always a limit. That is to say, with all kinds of efforts we are making, most Herculean tasks that we are performing today, including space travel and so on. But there is always a limit and encumbrance. The limit of the material field in the knowledge. The encumbrance of the material machinery in the power. As long as we remain only to the material field, even if we expand tremendously fast and try to bring space and time into contracting vanishing point, there is still a limit. But here also, the latest trend is highly significant of a freer future. As the outposts of scientific knowledge come more and more to be set on the borders that divide the material from the immaterial, so also the highest achievements of practical science are those which tend to simplify and reduce to the vanishing point the machinery by which the greatest effects are produced. Wireless telegraphy is nature's exterior sign and pretext for a new orientation. At the time when Sri Aurobindo wrote, wireless telegraphy was the last outpost of knowledge development. But even at that time, Sri Aurobindo has foreseen further developments and still further developments, which you can see here. In the wireless telegraphy, the sensible physical means for the intermediate transmission of the physical force is removed. It is only preserved at the points of impulsion and reception. Eventually, even these must disappear. And this is a great step Sri Aurobindo foresees in future. For when the laws and forces of the supraphysical are studied, with the right starting point, the means will infallibly be found for mind directly to seize on the physical energy and speed it accurately upon its errand. There, once we bring ourselves to recognize it, lie the gates that open upon the enormous vistas of the future. Yet even if he had the full knowledge and control of the worlds immediately above matter, there would still be a limitation and still a beyond. The last knot of our bondage is at that point where the external draws into oneness with the internal. The machinery of ego itself becomes subtilized to the vanishing point, and the law of our action is at last unity embracing and possessing multiplicity. And no longer as now, multiplicity struggling towards some figure of unity. There is a central throne of cosmic knowledge, looking out on her widest dominion. There the empire of oneself with the empire of one's world. There the life in the eternally consummate being and the realization of his divine nature in our human existence. But this is a very great height to which human consciousness is capable of reaching. And this height is further expounded by Sri Aurobindo in the next chapter. And I'll go straight to that point before coming back again to the beginning, because this is in the middle of the next chapter. It is the paragraph which begins with the extension of our consciousness.
Page number 20.
So, the extension of our consciousness, that is to say, we have reached a point where Sri Aurobindo speaks of the cosmic throne of knowledge. It is by extension of consciousness. So, the extension of our consciousness to be satisfying must necessarily be an inner enlargement from the individual into the cosmic existence. For the witness, if he exists, is not the individual embodied mind born in the world, but that cosmic consciousness embracing the universe and appearing as an immanent intelligence in all its works, to which either world subsists eternally and really as its own active existence, or else from which it is born and into which it disappears by an act of knowledge or by an act of conscious power. It is about this cosmic consciousness that now Sri Aurobindo describes in the next paragraph. The possibility of a cosmic consciousness in humanity is coming slowly to be admitted in modern psychology, like the possibility of more elastic instruments of knowledge. Although still classified, even when its value and power are admitted as a hallucination. This paragraph is very important for two reasons. The first is that when we enter into the world of the supraphysical, there are many levels of the supraphysical which we cover from stage to stage. And in each stage, there is a possibility of what is called cosmic consciousness. Cosmic consciousness is a consciousness which is not limited to our egoistic perception of things, in which ego is the center. But that center is broken and there is a larger and larger expansion of consciousness. Now, the science of cosmic consciousness is a necessary part of the new developments which are going to take place in due course of time with the advancement of science. Not merely physical science, but science as such, quest of knowledge. What are these different levels of cosmic consciousness? And Sri Aurobindo will describe these different levels of cosmic consciousness in this chapter, in this paragraph. And this is one reason why this particular paragraph is so important. And secondly, our modern psychology, about 100 years ago, a book did come out with the title Cosmic Consciousness. So it had made at that time a very great powerful impression in the fields of psychology and even philosophy. It was a book which described experiences of cosmic consciousness. And psychologists had to take cognizance of it. And as Sri Aurobindo says, that slowly this idea of cosmic consciousness is coming to be recognized in modern psychology, even though it is still classified as a hallucination. It is not regarded as something that is valid or that can be verifiable. Although in Eastern consciousness, cosmic consciousness has been recognized as a psychological fact. It's a truth of yoga, entry into cosmic consciousness has been admitted. But the remarkable fact is that even the West, where there is so much of hesitation, at least as a hallucination, it has been admitted that one can have a hallucinatory experience of cosmic consciousness. And in this chapter, in this paragraph, Sri Aurobindo describes now the various levels of cosmic consciousness. In the psychology of the East, it has always been recognized as a reality and the aim of our subjective progress. The essence of the passage over to this goal is the exceeding of the limits imposed upon us by the ego sense, and at least a partaking, at most an identification with the self-knowledge that broods secret in all life and in all that seems to us inanimate. Now in this we have the description of the cosmic consciousness. Entering into that consciousness, we may continue to dwell like it upon universal existence. Then we become aware, for all our terms of consciousness and even our sensational experience begin to change, of matter as one existence and of bodies as its formations, in which the one existence separates itself physically in the single body from itself in all others, and again by physical means establishes communication between these multitudinous points of its being. Mind we experience similarly, and life also, as the same existence, one in its multiplicity, separating and reuniting itself in each domain by means appropriate to that movement. And if we choose, we can proceed farther, and after passing through many linking stages, become aware of a supermind, whose universal operation is the key to all lesser activities. Nor do we become merely conscious of this cosmic existence, but likewise conscious in it, receiving it in sensation, but also entering into it in awareness. In it we live as we lived before in the ego sense, active, more and more in contact, even unified more and more with other minds, other lives, other bodies than the organism we call ourselves, producing effects not only on our own moral and mental being and on the subjective being of others, but even on the physical world and its events by means nearer to the divine than those possible to our egoistic capacity. There is a full chapter in the Synthesis of Yoga on cosmic consciousness. And when you have time, I would like you to study that chapter, because there is a more full description. But this is the most accurate description. It is said of Sri Ramakrishna that when some animal was being beaten up, Sri Ramakrishna had the signs of colds on his own physical body. This is a result of a cosmic consciousness spread out at a given moment, so that what is happening to the animal physical consciousness is seen physically on the one's own body. So this is one of the great marks of an advanced state of consciousness. You cannot doubt it. I mean, if you have this kind of experience where you can contact what is happening in the other consciousness on a large scale, in fact, universalization of consciousness was recognized as a very important state right from the Vedic times. In fact, one of the greatest achievements of the Vedic seers was to make the physical consciousness universalized. That if you rise higher and higher, the higher levels are more easy to widen themselves. Vital being is very narrow normally. Even very profound saints in their vital being can be seen to be quite narrow. In your personal relationships there are many problems and knots of personal connections, as a result of which there can be a lot of quarrels in the vital world, even of saints. And it is not easy for them to resolve the problems of personal relationships on account of this narrowness in one's own vital consciousness. When you come to the mental plane, it is much easier. In fact, in all of us, in the mental plane, we can be much wider, much more universal, quite easily. When you read a book together, there is a great harmony among all of us. There is a mental harmony because of the automatic wideness which occurs in the mental consciousness. At a still higher level, the consciousness automatically becomes wider and wider and wider. Narrownesses of all kinds are crossed more easily. But to bring down this wideness on lower and lower planes of consciousness, very difficult task. Even two great philosophers who are very mentally very developed, if they are brought to the field of debate in the presence of people, they can be quite rigid. Although when they are alone, they may be quite polite and quite accommodative of each other. Why? Because here they are exhibited. There is an exhibition going on. It's a question of connections and interconnections, which are vital in character, not more mental. And therefore the narrowness comes about more easily, and strong positions can be taken when a debate takes place, even though in your drawing room you may be more accommodative. But when you go into a still deeper level of physical consciousness, the narrowness and egoism become very powerful. Now to bring down cosmic consciousness, even in the physical, is one of the topmost capacities and highest achievement which has been recorded in the Rig Veda. And the words which are used, as Sri Aurobindo points out, in one of the Vedic verses of Parashara, is Prithvi Vitasthe. Prithvi, the physical consciousness, Vitasthe. V is the widening, universalization. Vitasthe, even the physical consciousness was widened, universalized. So, and that is, according to Vedic Rishis, the mark of the attainment of immortality. Because this particular verse comes in connection with the path of immortality. So Sri Aurobindo says that according to the Vedic Rishis, when the physical consciousness got universalized by the power of the cosmic consciousness of the highest coming down, the supreme cosmic consciousness is supermind. That supreme consciousness brought down to the physical plane. As a result, the physical consciousness became universalized. It may be permanent, it may be at least temporary, but even temporary universalization is a tremendous achievement. And Sri Aurobindo says that in the history of yoga, it was one of the highest points, or perhaps the highest point which was reached in the history of yoga. And when a further attempt was made to fix that universal consciousness in the physical consciousness, it was found to be impossible. It is there that Mother says, in the past universalization was obtained, but it could not be fixed in the physical consciousness, which Mother said she herself took many, many years. Only in 1970 she declared, it is now fixed. The universal consciousness got fixed, the supramental cosmic consciousness got fixed in the physical consciousness. It is that which is the most significant development in the history of yoga. Therefore, this science of cosmic consciousness is so important. One of the great marks of a true yogi is this capacity of universalization. It's not merely ordinary capacities of creating ring and so on. It is this universality of consciousness, and to be able to dwell in that cosmic consciousness. These are the high marks of the tests. And even these tests have again to be determined by criteria. And that's why Mother speaks of the criterion of equality of consciousness under all circumstances as a criterion. If you are truly established in universal consciousness, at lower and lower levels of consciousness, you can remain equal-minded. What Sri Krishna has spoken of in the Bhagavad Gita as a test of Sita Pragya, because that was the question, how to test the Sita Pragya. That was the question of criterion. And Arjuna had asked a question, is there any method by which you can judge from the speech of the Sita Pragya, from the way in which he walks? Can these be the marks of a Sita Pragya? Sri Krishna does not answer that question directly, to indicate that by speech and by walking you cannot determine whether somebody is a saint or not, or is living in cosmic consciousness or not. But he says the mark of it is that he has no desire. That is one test. If you put any desire before him, that will be a testing. You can test. As Vivekananda tried to test Sri Ramakrishna by putting a coin in his cloth. And it is said that when Sri Ramakrishna came to touch that cloth, and immediately threw it away and said, "What is this?" I mean, his physical, there was no temptation at all of any kind, that mastery of desire. That is how Vivekananda tested his own master. So, yogic science is so greatly developed, only we have not visited it properly. So many tests, but most important test, Mother says, is of equality. In what circumstances you can remain equal-minded, it is sometimes the circumstances are so troublesome, so trying. That is why one of the marks of Janaka was that he was seated in the conference of saints and debaters, and he was told his palace is burnt away. And there was no effect on him at all. And he continued as before, as if nothing had happened. This was the mark of the sthita pragya condition of Janaka. So, when the condition of consciousness remains so unmoved, equal-minded, is not tempted, that is the test. It is the larger this cosmic consciousness, the larger is your capacity. But even more than that, if you can establish even beyond the cosmic consciousness, and it is to that which you are now turning, to the consideration of the transcendental consciousness. As you can see, in the first four chapters, Sri Aurobindo first of all explains how the human aspiration is for the highest and the best. You can define this highest and best in whatever way you like. Sri Aurobindo has given four terms: God, light, freedom, immortality. If you don't like those terms, don't use those terms. It doesn't matter. If you say, "Oh, man wants to be omniscient and omnipotent," use those terms if you like. Like modern scientist wants to conquer the whole world, you can say that modern science is aiming at proving that the whole world can be in your hands. They want to prove that we can create a human baby, what people think that only God can make. But we can make it also. So, in other words, that's a mark of human aspiration. Human aspiration is to be as God is. Whatever is claimed by God, man wants to claim and he wants it. That is his aspiration. So having said that this aspiration exists, having shown that this aspiration is rationally justifiable, and this rational justification Sri Aurobindo shows on the ground of two main arguments. That the method of nature is a method of harmonization. And at present that harmonization does not exist. Therefore, if what is being aimed at is the supreme harmonization, it is a rational justification. Already harmonization has been achieved when life is in matter and mind is in life. That harmonization has already taken place. Therefore, if a supramental harmonization is aimed at, there is nothing unnatural about it, not unjustifiable. And second argument is the argument of evolution. That if life has evolved in matter, if mind has evolved in life, what is impossible for supermind to evolve out of the mind is also justifiable. On both these grounds, Sri Aurobindo said, this aspiration is justifiable. But having shown this, Sri Aurobindo considers this whole problem again from a larger point of view. We are presented a larger canvas of argumentation, and we are told that this ideal can be questioned from the side of the materialists and also from the side of one who holds spiritual truths to be the highest. Both these levels can put questions against what is being proposed. According to materialism, matter alone is real. According to the spiritual man, spiritual is the only thing that is highest, but spirit can be attained only when you renounce matter. That is his argument. Therefore, if you are proposing to have higher spiritual consciousness in the human body, in the bodily existence, then that can be questioned. Because of these two very important possibilities of argument, Sri Aurobindo takes us through these two negations, the denial of the materialist and the refusal of the ascetic. And in doing so, Sri Aurobindo takes us step by step and saying how far the material knowledge itself has reached now, where the boundaries of material knowledge have been attained, and how we can go beyond the boundaries of the physical. And when we do so, we reach a cosmic consciousness. And what are the possibilities of judging cosmic consciousness? And therefore the question of criteria of supraphysical knowledge had to be discussed, which he has discussed. And then, having arrived at the supramental cosmic consciousness, Sri Aurobindo says that he who has got the supramental cosmic consciousness, he has no doubt about it. He has proof of it within himself. So Sri Aurobindo says, real then to the man who has had contact with it, that is with cosmic consciousness, or lives in it, is this cosmic consciousness with a greater than the physical reality, real in itself, real in its effects and works. The supramental consciousness does not doubt itself. It is subjective, objective in such an extent that there is no possibility of doubt. It is self-validated. And as it is thus real to the world, and as it is thus real to the world, which is his own total expression, so is the world real to it, but not as an independent existence. For in that higher and less hampered experience, we perceive that consciousness and being are not different from each other, but all being is a supreme consciousness. All consciousness is self-existence, eternal in itself, real in its works, and neither a dream nor an evolution. Now, this description of the cosmic consciousness is extremely important, particularly for a philosophical understanding. We had seen at the beginning that philosophy is primarily connected with all physical and psychological facts. Secondly, it is an attempt to determine the significance of all these facts and the essential significance. And this significance is to be decided from the point of view of the totality. That's a philosophical point of view. And in the search of totality, it may even need to go beyond all the facts that we are normally concerned with. This is the fundamental method of philosophy. Now, life divine is supremely philosophical because it rises from step to step, and at every step it takes into account physical and psychological facts as they come in our view of our search. And most important difficult task is to describe the physical and psychological fact accurately. Many of the philosophical dilemmas, confusions, debates have arisen because our data are not accurately described. I have not read any book comparable to the Life Divine in which the data of the physical and psychological facts are accurately described. This precision, this accuracy, par excellence in the Life Divine. There is no error whatsoever in the description of any state of existence. Even matter, for example, if you want to get the absolutely correct definition of matter, take for example, there is a chapter here called The Ascending Series of Substance, where Sri Aurobindo gives an exact description of matter. The very first paragraph. The most accurate experience of matter that we see, the full orbed description of matter, Sri Aurobindo says, if we consider what it is that most represents to us the materiality of matter, we shall see that it is its aspects of solidity, tangibility, increasing resistance, firm response to the touch of sense. In these 4-5 words, he has given accurate description of what we call materiality of matter. Sri Aurobindo's mastery of descriptions is truly amazing, because whether it is the description of a flower or a branch or of a season or of a cloud or of a tree or of a mood of tranquility, of silence, of dynamism, of hope, of despair, the sunshine of hope and the dark night of depression. In whatever condition you want to see the descriptions, most accurate descriptions we find in Sri Aurobindo. It's the most amazing capacity of describing, appreciating and giving the most essential point which accurately describes what is to be described. And therefore, there is authenticity of arriving at a real knowledge of physical and psychological facts. And this description of Sri Aurobindo, what he has given of the cosmic consciousness, in a few words, that he described in a long way in the Synthesis of Yoga. But even in these few words, the whole cosmic consciousness is brought into a clear daylight, as it were. So, this description that Sri Aurobindo, the world, he says it is in the cosmic consciousness, the world is real precisely because it exists only in consciousness. this statement, what is the proof of existence? The idea of proof itself arises only in the context of consciousness. Mountain does not demand the proof of mountain. There is no consciousness of the mountain in the mountain demanding the proof whether it exists or not. It is only consciousness that demands a proof. And why does it demand a proof? Because it is a subjective consciousness in which somehow the objectivity is contained. This, what we distinguish in subjectivity and objectivity as if two opposite things, they are not really opposite. The objectivity is only a state of subjectivity seen by subjectivity as other than itself. And that is the authenticity of objectivity. How do I know that objectivity is really objective? My subjectivity itself must be able to see the objectivity as objectivity. Otherwise, I will never have the proof of objectivity. My subjectivity must be capable of putting objectivity against itself, itself against itself, and knowing itself. Sri Krishna is sure of Radha because Radha is himself Sri Krishna. And Radha is the objectivization of Sri Krishna. And Krishna knows that this is the objectivization of Sri Krishna. Only because of this identity in the difference that the real proof can be obtained. So Sri Aurobindo says, the world is real precisely because it exists only in consciousness. It is a conscious energy one with being that creates it. I repeat that sentence, very important. It's a conscious energy one with being that creates it. It is the existence of material form in its own right, apart from the self-illumined energy which assumes the form. That would be a contradiction of the truth of things, a phantasmagoria, a nightmare, an impossible falsehood. If a being can be created without consciousness, or if a consciousness can exist without the being, that would be an illusion. But that is, it is not so. The world is not a phantasmagoria. It's a real manifestation of consciousness. Because consciousness itself is the being. We have reached, therefore, a very high level of our inquiry, and we have come to this high point of cosmic consciousness. Now we are about to enter into the next step. Having entered into cosmic consciousness, Sri Aurobindo says, this is not the topmost height to which we can reach. There are still other levels of consciousness. But this conscious being, which is the truth of the infinite supermind, is more than the universe and lives independently in its own inexpressible infinity as well as in the cosmic harmonies. This is a very important sentence. It's a summary of the ninth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita where Sri Krishna says, they are in me, I am not in them. I am all of them, they are me, I am in them, I am in them, but I am not in them. This paradoxical statement that we find in the Bhagavad Gita in the ninth chapter is expressed in metaphysical terms in these words. This conscious being, which is the truth of the infinite supermind, is more than the universe and lives independently in its own inexpressible infinity as well as in the cosmic harmonies. this capacity to live in itself and independent of cosmic harmonies is another state of consciousness. It's a supraphysical consciousness, but in the science of the supraphysical, this is one of the topmost levels at which you arrive, and this is described accurately. And we have got to describe that as a datum. If you want to have philosophy, you should be true to the data. And these data have to be obtained and to be harmonized with the totality of the world. You will not be able to explain the world unless this datum is admitted, or the truth of it is stated, acknowledged, in the light of which alone the world can be truly explained. And you find the truth cannot be explained, the world of cannot be explained, if you don't admit this truth of existence and consciousness. This world, Sri Aurobindo says, world lives by that. That does not live by the world. And as we can enter into the cosmic consciousness and be one with all cosmic existence, so we can enter into the world transcending consciousness and become superior to all cosmic existence. And then arises the question which first occurred to us, whether this transcendence is necessarily also a rejection. What relation has this universe to the beyond? This is a fact that transcends the world. It can live without the world. This is a fact, a datum of existence, is a consciousness. And therefore the question is very powerful. This kind of experience has been experienced in yoga.